The views and opinions expressed by the guests on the following program do not necessarily represent those of Mark Radio, The Shepherd, or its advertisers.
From the studios of the Shepherd Radio Network, it's Afternoons with Mike. This next hour is all about our walk with Jesus, with local pastors, newsmakers, people who are making a difference for the gospel. Now, here is your host, Mike Gilland.
Hey friends, and welcome to the Monday edition of Afternoons with Mike. It is a real pleasure to have Katie Talento back on. Katie is the Executive Director of the Alliance of Healthcare Sharing Ministries, and they oversee all of these ministries that we talk often about, being like MediShare and Samaritan, as well as others. Katie's over all of that, but her background goes way beyond just healthcare sharing. She served in the White House, and we'll hear all about that story as our program goes on today. So, Katie Talento, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you know, Katie, when I talked with you before, it was without the first time we had an interview, it was without that understanding of your background. Of course, you're based right now in the D.C. area, I believe. That was the case. Is that still the case?
Yes, I'm actually out in the Loudoun County area where, we've got a Paris resistance going on here.
Oh, my goodness. That made the news, obviously, before the governor, Youngkin, became the governor, and all of the school board meetings. There's a lot going on, especially with last week's State of the Union address and our finding out, surprisingly, from President Biden that the vax is now being used to cure cancer. I did not know that. That was...
Well, I think what he's saying is that the mRNA technology is being experimented on in cancer.
Yeah, that was a long stretch to what was actually uttered, though. So, yeah, you're right. It was quite an amazing time. So the point is, Katie, these are times, aren't they, where you just have to be beyond just your normal scope of what you're an expert in. In your case, you've done both sides. You've worked with the politicians. You're working with the people. You're working with the companies that oversee these companies like Health Sharing Ministries. So you've got a pretty wide breadth of experience under your belt, and we're glad to have you on board today.
Well, it's a delight to be here. And, healthcare is a sixth of the economy. So if you focus on healthcare, you got a big portfolio.
You know, that was something that was talked about a lot under the years of Obamacare when it was first coming out. But to control healthcare was to control, like you said, not only the health situation of America's, but a great deal of the economy. So there is a dollar and cents part to all of the healthcare.
Yeah, I mean, I think dollars and cents are what drives most of what we see in healthcare. It's a really corrupted industry. And, I think all of us have experienced feeling like we're just cogs in a giant bureaucratic machine that's, predatory and exploitative and doesn't have our best interests at heart. So I think that, as all of us enter into the healthcare system ourselves, and especially when we're trying to advocate for loved ones, we see it up close. And when the bills start coming in, all the frustrations you had with the quality of care and the way your loved one was treated get compounded when you start seeing the predatory billing and the exploitation of the poor and the profiteering and the price gouging, the lack of transparency. It's a market like no other. It's really not a market at all. You don't have transparent prices. Unlike any other industry, there's all kinds of middlemen with their hands out, driving prices up in ways that we don't even appreciate. Even experts in healthcare don't understand how it all works and how all the middlemen are involved and don't even know the names of the types of industries of middlemen. There are industries of middlemen that healthcare experts don't even understand all of them. So it's a massive, massive Leviathan, honestly. And all of us have to be on guard when we enter the system. And honestly, what I've learned from COVID, frankly, was the best thing to do is stay out of the system, right? The best thing to do is to aggressively take care of our own health and learn how to take care of as much of our health at home as we can and to prevent problems and really change our lifestyles. I think if there's a silver lining to the pandemic, that's it.
You know, I heard years ago, and I think it's true, I'm hearing it more and more, that we all, every citizen in our country, we all need to be our own advocate when it comes to our own health care. If we're not involved, if we're not adding our opinion, if you will, as to what's going on, we're really missing out. We're not living in a day where we can just trust our doctors, well-meaning as he or she may be, our health care system. We can't just trust them, can we?
No, I mean, I think what we saw is that a lot of these sort of mainstream medical thinking is just like a religious groupthink cult. I mean, there's just no critical thinking. There's no intellectual curiosity. It's just parroting talking points from, and this is not surprising given how medical education is. So, when you are learning to be a doctor, all you do is regurgitate what you think your superiors want to hear. Even it's not just, I'm memorizing anatomy or I'm memorizing the Krebs cycle. It's beyond, even after you're out of the classroom and you're in your clinical rotation, you're just being demanded to regurgitate, whatever the party line is. Well, this is what we do when we see this symptom. And this is what we do when we see this lab result. It's just memorization and regurgitation, that's not critical thinking. And I think that, doctors and their white coats and the authority and the respect that the profession has enjoyed has had the luxury of for decades and decades is, I think we're all sort of seeing that it's being exposed for not quite as authoritative as it's been, represented to us. And that we all have to kind of rethink that, maybe our doctors are not the experts in health that we thought they were. They're basically an expert in, what the party line is for how to deliver sick care. But that's not how to deliver health care. And it's not how to maintain health. And it doesn't mean that they have a scientific expertise and that they understand studies and that they're staying up to date on studies. I mean, you just can't assume that about your doctor anymore.
For years, we've had this opinion that American medical the whole program, the whole industry, if you will, was the envy of other countries, and we've been told that. But a lot of people that I've talked to have the opinion and are of the thought that we have gone backwards a little bit in the last decade, especially since Obamacare. Would you share that?
100%. I mean, we've gone backwards in the last generation. We have the sickest children on earth. We are the fattest and most chronically ill of all rich countries. We our life expectancy is going down. It's going in the wrong direction. So, I think that if you look and see, our children's IQ has dropped. We have more poisonous water. We have more poisonous food than most other rich countries because they ban a number of things that are allowed in our country on our food and water, in our air, in our home products. So, there's a massive chemical industry out there. There's a massive agricultural industry. And, these industries are just like the healthcare industry, which we all saw during COVID, have been totally captured. The regulators that are supposed to protect, us from the corporate interests that would, put profits before people, those regulators are now protecting those regulated entities from us, not the other way around. So it's really scary. And yeah, I think we've made a lot of backward progress, unfortunately.
It really feels that way. And even to the tune of when we were promised from President Obama back then that we'd be able to keep our own doctors. And that turned out to be something less than genuine as well. And we found out that this Affordable Care Act was anything but affordable.
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, in the first 5 years of the ACA, premiums doubled and deductibles tripled. So, it certainly drove costs up. There are some structural reasons for that. When you start to guarantee that you can sign up for insurance after you're already sick and that insurance will cover pre-existing conditions, it's sort of like, I mean, it sounds really good. It's something we all want. It sounds like an important consumer protection, but it's similar to Geico or Allstate saying, sure, you can insure your car after you've wrecked it. So obviously, if that were the case in car insurance, it would dramatically drive up car insurance premiums, right?
Right.
And the same thing happened in healthcare. That's exactly what happened. And in healthcare, we have a term for that, or actually in insurance, there's a term for that, and it's called the death spiral. So when the risk pool becomes riskier and riskier because they're sicker and older and sicker and older people, then the younger, healthy people, they don't see a value in it because it's gotten so expensive. So they leave. They just find some other alternative, like, for instance, the healthcare sharing ministry, or not being insured, or staying in the cash pay economy. And so as they leave, then the pool is now sicker and older and sicker and older and more expensive. So then more people leave, and it eventually becomes unsustainable. I do think there has been some arresting of that death spiral in the subsequent 5 years. So the first 5 years were very troubling for the ACA. But President Trump came in, and one of the first things we did was try to put in some rules to stabilize that market. You know, this is providing insurance for, you know, millions of people, and we did not want the death spiral to continue. So there were some regulations that came in that tried to stabilize it. And we did, actually. Premiums went down for the first time after those first 5 years, and enrollment in the ACA exchanges stabilized. And now there are so many subsidies, especially after the COVID aid packages. There's so many subsidies on the ACA market that more and more people can actually afford that kind of insurance if they want it, which is a whole other question, especially for religious people of conscience, as insurance is increasingly being required by states to cover abortions or transgender procedures and IVF and contraception and all the things that some religious people may have objections to. So there may be other reasons to get out of insurance, but you know, it's the law of the land at this point, the ACA is. And you know, I think we saw what happens when you try to repeal and replace it. The votes aren't there. You know, the government pays for half of all healthcare in this country, you know, with Medicaid covering between 1 in 5 or 1 in 6 Americans. And then you've got many more people on the exchanges receiving subsidies, Medicare, the VA, the military. There's so many people that are dependent on government paid healthcare that it's really difficult to take away anything from people. And they viewed repeal and replace as doing that. I'll never forget Ronald Reagan said that the closest thing to eternal life is a government program. So I don't think we're gonna repeal or replace any of these programs anytime soon.
You know, I don't think people realize from the standpoint of involvement by the government in the ACA. I think a lot of people do not realize that what you said was so true, that part of the way the ACA was designed was a government subsidy. In other words, they are kicking in, the United States government, and that means all the taxpayers out there, they're all kicking in to make these, quote, affordable prices, end quote, affordable. And so in a real way, it's not like you have a well-managed system where the whole system is kind of paying for itself, right? I mean, you've got people helping you make the premium payments. Is that right?
Oh, that's right. I mean, it's far from paying for itself. The vast majority of people who have an ACA plan that they buy on their state or the federal ACA marketplace are subsidized for their either all or part of their premiums and all or part of their cost sharing once they have insurance, so their deductibles and copays. And that was dramatically expanded during COVID. It used to be up to if you made up to 250% of the federal poverty line, you could get all your cost sharing and premiums waived. And then if you made up to 400% of poverty line, you could get your premiums, but maybe not your cost sharing waived. Under COVID, that was expanded to really just almost anyone. So if you're poor, if you're really low income, then you qualify for Medicaid. And Medicaid is probably one of the most generous plans, if not the most generous plan. So almost no cost sharing and no premiums. And then if you make too much to qualify for Medicaid, then you will qualify for ACA subsidies. You really have to be doing very well in order to not qualify for subsidies. And most people who are doing very well are employed. And so they have a job, they have insurance on the job. Half of all Americans with insurance get their insurance on the job. And then, of course, if you're permanently disabled or you're a senior, then you can qualify for Medicare. So, you know, these are, and that doesn't even speak to the Indian Health Service or the VA or the DOD systems. But yeah, it's healthcare does not pay for itself right now. It's not a sustainable business model. It's built on exploitation, price gouging, opaqueness in pricing, hiding of funding streams between middlemen and kickbacks that, you know, Congress used to outlaw, but lobbyists have obtained exceptions from those laws banning kickbacks in healthcare. So it's a corrupt industry all around, honestly.
It really is. It's very scary when you look out now, and you've mentioned all these other causes, if you will, all of the different sources of problems. But one of them is the coming problem, and it's being developed right now. And that would be what happens when all of these that are coming in, these undocumented illegal aliens, if you will, that are crossing our border right now, that our blue states and the president is offering basically a free ride, healthcare ride. What's going to happen with all of that?
Well, not every state is doing that, but you're right. You mentioned the blue states. It's bankrupting them. You know, it's bankrupting California. Even Texas is bankrupted. But, you know, beyond the healthcare costs, which are numerous, but there's the education costs as well. Just paying for the schools. You know, if you look at any state budget, what are their top two, you know, line items? It's education and it's Medicaid. So those are really being stretched by just a wide open border, and it's not sustainable. I don't know what's going to happen. And I really feel for those border states, even though, you know, we're all becoming border states. I live in Virginia, and, you know, we've got massive, massive amounts of illegal immigrants here that our education system is really struggling with. We don't have enough Spanish teachers for all the English as second language classes that we need. I think that's true everywhere. And so I don't know what's going to happen, but it's certainly, you know, what cannot sustain itself will not. So we'll see.
Now, you've mentioned that a couple of times, the word unsustainable. And I know that none of us have a crystal ball that we can look into the future and say, hey, this is going to happen 5 years from now. But when you look at short term, there are a lot of things that appear to be rather unsustainable on the short term, too. What would you think from your position in the whole sharing ministry role that you play? What do you think is going to be some of the low-hanging fruit that's going to happen first? What are the things that we can watch out for?
That's going to happen in healthcare?
Yes.
Yeah, well, I think there is a pushback. There is a trend right now that I find very encouraging, and that is that there is bipartisan support for price transparency in healthcare. That was really driven by President Trump. You know, during his term, when he pushed for it against many, many, many Swampian interests in the healthcare swamp. So I do think that really has taken hold. I mean, you saw Super Bowl ads that had rappers and country stars advocating for price transparency, which is awesome. You know, you've got patient groups out there that are demanding this, and Congress has passed a couple bills now on it. And so we have good new law. I think that, we need more. We need to enforce the laws we have on the books. But I do think that increasingly you're seeing some good news in that front. And that's certainly good for healthcare sharing ministries. Many of our ministries really live and die on price transparency. They really have to steer their members to the lowest cost and highest quality sites of care in order to best steward the donations and contributions from their members. So, you know, unlike a big insurance company, which actually makes money if there are higher prices, I know that's counterintuitive, but it's true in terms of how their business model works. You know, healthcare sharing ministries, they have to guard every dollar. And so price transparency is really important. So I think that Congress is even now considering more price transparency, especially in the pharmacy space, in the drug space, where there hasn't been much. So President Trump enacted price transparency for hospitals, health plans, and drugs, but the drug piece was delayed indefinitely by the Biden administration, unfortunately.
Let me step in right now. We got to take a break. Let's keep that up in a moment when we get back. My guest today, Katie Tolento, and I'll be right back.
If you're a Christian business person and you want to meet people who want to do business with you, you need to join the Central Florida Christian Chamber of Commerce. Why? Because the mission of the Christian Chamber is to build kingdom, business, and community. And it all starts with the Christian principle of building relationships. To learn more about the Christian Chamber and all the different ways you can get engaged with hundreds of other Central Florida Christian business people, visit cfchristianchamber.com or call 407-258-3578.
My guest today is Katie Tolento, and she is such an expert when it comes to all things healthcare sharing ministries. She's the executive director of the Alliance for that very thing, and she also has great experience, which we're going to hear about from the White House. But already we can tell that you have a real good grasp on a lot of these issues that not only have we faced since Obamacare came into place in America, but even the things that are going on right now. And you did talk about some of these new efforts, which are actually bringing a little bit of, let's say, comfort and maybe help regarding transparency and prices. But there are other things that are going on that are not working as well. And again, falls into that camp of being unsustainable. So you were talking about something President Biden is currently doing. Go ahead and continue.
Yeah, so when President Trump issued price transparency regulations for health plans, it required health plans to post their prices, their out-of-network prices, their in-network prices, and their net drug costs, which would have forced plans to actually give up some critical information about the drug supply chain that's utterly hidden right now. And so, of course, this shadowy industry of middlemen called pharmacy benefit managers, which are really, I would say, largely responsible for high drug costs, not drug manufacturers, although they are no angels, obviously. But really, I would say it's this middlemen industry, middlemen companies, mostly three large companies that control 80% of the pharmacy market, which is CVS Caremark and Optum Rx and Express Scripts. Those three companies control about 80% of all insured people's drug prescription benefits. And they sued. They sued the Trump administration, and then President Trump left. And so President Biden basically, I think, talked them down from their lawsuit by just agreeing to delay indefinitely that price transparency requirement for them. So there is no price transparency in the drug market, unfortunately. And it's really a really corrupt industry. And in fact, one kind of exciting thing that's happening, you asked sort of what good things are happening in the sense of trying to resolve some of these unsustainable trends. And one of them is that employers and employees are getting smart about their power. So, you know, employers, like I said earlier, they fund half of all insured people get their insurance on the job. And so employers, they have a special role in being fiduciaries of their health plans. And that's very hard to do if you don't have a good benefits advisor, because, you know, nobody's an expert in these things. And these giant companies have a real asymmetry of power. You know, I've seen contracts between an insurance carrier and employer that are, you know, 60 pages long with all kinds of terms and conditions that no normal person could understand or fight back against. And even if they tried, they would just be, you know, Cigna is going to say, take it or leave it. We're not changing our contract for you. But one thing that's really encouraging is that the employees have a role if their health plan is not being managed well, and the vast majority of them are not, for all the reasons I've explained, no fault really of their employer. They can sue their employer under a law called ERISA, which is the law that governs a lot of insurance plans today. And in fact, there is a lawsuit out there that was just filed by the employees of Johnson & Johnson, the big pharmaceutical company, not for their drug products and as in their capacity as a pharmaceutical manufacturer, but actually in their capacity as an employer. So they basically said, listen, you are being pillaged by one of these big pharmacy benefit managers, and it's driven up our prices outrageously and beyond market rates because you're not minding the store. And so you're a bad fiduciary. And so they sued, and it's a really important lawsuit to be watching. Mm. And there are others out there as well that are kind of similar. But I'm encouraged by those lawsuits.
So basically those lawsuits at least bring hope for some accountability, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, you don't want to, we thought about, I've sort of plotted with patient groups and others about how can we create the right lawsuits, right? We really want employers to be sued, not because we want to punish employers, because in many ways, in large ways, they are the victims just as much as patients. And so we were trying to think, well, maybe we can find like an unsympathetic employer. And Johnson & Johnson is perfect. Like finding a pharmaceutical manufacturer is the perfect employer. They should know better more than anyone else. They should know better. And so I think that's encouraging, because truly employers are getting pillaged, and it's not their fault for the most part, but they are the only hope, because although it's not their fault, it is their responsibility. And so if they would take their responsibility seriously, you could have really big change. And you are seeing a little trend out there of employers starting to do innovative things, firing their giant pharmacy benefit managers, firing their carrier like Blue Cross or Aetna, and instead hiring small upstart kind of innovative, independent plan administrators and independent pharmacy benefit managers, and learning that, hey, if we add this thing called direct primary care, we can prevent our people from getting sick and manage their chronic diseases without having to go to the emergency rooms and use high cost drugs or dialysis. And so, you know, there is a little trend out there and it's growing. And so that is encouraging, but also that's kind of on the employer side. On the individual side, you know, for people who are individuals and they're not getting insurance on the job, and they're maybe, you know, truck drivers or small business owners, you know, the idea of a healthcare sharing ministry is also a great alternative. And as we see that trend growing, in that healthcare sharing ministry membership really grew after the ACA, because one interesting thing about the ACA is that it exempted members of healthcare sharing ministries from that law's individual mandate. You know, you have to buy insurance that the government defines as adequate. And if you don't, you get a big tax penalty. And although President Trump and the Republican Congress in 2017 zeroed out that penalty, it still is a mandate that you have to have insurance. That's still the law. They can't enforce it, but it's still the law. And so having that ACA exemption for healthcare sharing ministries really allowed healthcare sharing ministries to grow during that time as people were looking for an exit ramp off the ACA mandate and into something more affordable and consistent with their religious beliefs.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment, because this exit ramp, as you mentioned it, with is sharing ministries, that is surprisingly effective and actually works, and not the same way that the ACA works. There is not like a generous benefactor who's kicking in, but instead the concept of each member kind of pulling their own weight and helping other members in need is actually proving to work, right?
Yeah, I kind of think of it like a homeschool co-op for healthcare. So, you know, you have a group of people who share religious beliefs. They come together and they say, okay, everyone needs to bear their own load. But when your own load becomes unaffordable and unbearable, then the community is going to help share that load, just like in the book of Acts. And so what we do is, you know, you go to the doctor, you tell the doctor, I'm uninsured, I'm a cash pay patient, or I'm a member of healthcare sharing ministry, and you get your care, and then you ask for an itemized bill. You upload that itemized bill to the ministry's portal. The ministry looks at that bill, makes sure that, you know, all the services that you received are eligible for sharing. You know, it's not like it's an abortion or a gender surgery or something. And so, and then the ministry taps several other members on the shoulder and says, hey, we need you to send your monthly contribution this month to that family over there in need that had that bill. Mm-hmm. And so that family is going to get money in the mail or through PayPal or just electronically transferred to them through the ministry's software, Or sometimes the ministry will just aggregate that the payments from those members and pay the doctor or the hospital directly. Each of them works a little differently.
But the point is, it's working. And like you said, there are differences between, let's say, MediShare and Samaritan. My wife and I were part of Samaritan for a couple of years and found that it was a surprisingly good alternative. I love that metaphor you gave us of the exit ramp. And I'm wondering, with things continuing to develop as they are in the country, it only seems reasonable to say that more and more Americans are going to be looking for an off-ramp to this plan. Wouldn't that be right?
Well, I think that's right. You know, premiums in the insurance market continue to go up. And, you know, just this year, we saw employer-sponsored insurance going up, premiums going up by another almost 7%. That's just a trend every year, right? So after a few years, you're talking about a 50% increase. After a few more years, you're talking about doubling, you know? So it's just not, like we said, not sustainable. And for an individual family that doesn't have an employer kicking in, maybe you're a business owner, or you're falling on hard times, or, you know, you're a wage earner. In those situations, like, there's not a reasonable option. But that's just from the financial side. I think the moral side is equally important. So, like I mentioned, there are more and more states that are mandating that insurance cover abortion, that are mandating that insurance cover in vitro fertilization or gender surgeries and reassignment and, you know, hormone therapies for kids that, you know, are confused about their gender. And those types of services are being required of all insurance plans. And the Biden administration has tried to make a lot of that true on the federal exchange plans as well, although they're not quite as successful as the states. States very much regulate the individual market in their own states. And so you've got blue states where, you know, Christians are going to have a really hard time justifying subsidizing the abortions of other people, you know? And so if they're looking for something that doesn't violate their religious conscience, healthcare sharing may be the only option for them.
Mm-hmm. And so that gives a real opportunity for people. I'm grateful that we've had this scenario where they have been granted this exemption from the ACA. Are there any threats to that exemption that you see on the horizon?
So far, no, but we are always watching with due vigilance because you never know. But I think so far we have not seen any efforts to do that. I think there are threats out there in the world, especially in blue states, in that, you know, insurance commissioners and others who really think that the ACA is the one-size-fits-all solution that's best for everybody. And, you know, they think that with good intentions. But, you know, they're thinking about, well, gosh, you can get this free insurance. You can get these subsidies and it's this awesome coverage. And, you know, but I think they want our people who are in healthcare sharing ministries, they want them in their insurance pool. Remember what I said about,
yeah, right.
You know, the more people that are in there. And now that there is no longer an individual mandate, which was the way that they subsidized all the older, sicker people in the exchanges, by forcing younger people into them through the mandate. Now that that mandate is no longer enforceable, I think these insurance commissioners around the country are nervous and they want more and more people back in their pool. Mm-hmm. And so they do us. There also have been some bad actors posing as healthcare sharing ministries that have, you know, threatened our reputation and certainly threatened the good faith of people who've been deceived by them. So I think there, for that reason, regulators have taken an interest as well. And so we've had to respond to those threats as well, certainly by creating checklists and just, you know, helping people identify a reliable and authentic healthcare sharing ministry that is in fact a healthcare sharing ministry and not a poser. And so there's an independent third-party accreditation board out there that accredits healthcare sharing ministries. We recommend that people look and see if their healthcare sharing ministry that they're exploring or that they're already a member of is accredited or in the process of undergoing accreditation. That's always our recommendation. They should certainly ask a healthcare sharing ministry if they have been recognized by the federal government as exempt from the ACA. If they have, then they will have a letter from the Department of Health and Human Services that says as much. They should always ask to see that ministry's annual audits. Those are required by the ACA to be available to the public upon request. They should ask to see that they're tax exempt under the IRS and that they're actually a nonprofit charity. You should be able to request that of a ministry or look it up on the IRS lookup tool. So these are some of the basic things that you can do to make sure that you're joining a reputable organization. But if you are, like, it's a great, great solution.
Now, give us, if you will, because we're coming up to a break here in a moment, give us, if you will, how people can find out more about the Alliance and maybe learn in general about healthcare sharing. How would they do that?
Yeah, so we're at, it's our acronym, Alliance of Healthcare Sharing Ministries. It's ahcsm.org, ahcsm.org. And you can check us out and learn more about the ministries. We have five member ministries: MediShare, Samaritan, Liberty Health Share, Altrua Health Share, and One Share Health. And all of those are great organizations people should check out.
So basically, the thing that you said, which I had not heard that term bad actor used inside of this context of healthcare sharing ministries, any of those five companies that you just mentioned, people can have, they can rest assured in their own heart that they're going to have a good experience, right?
That's right. That's right.
And are there any real colossal differences within those five?
Each of them has its own personality, and they operate a little bit differently. So you were a member of Samaritan, and so, you know, you're always going to get, like, checks in the mail and notes, and they're very old school, and it's really beautiful. And then there are others that are super, super high tech, and, you know, they automate the transfer of funds between the members, and it's really impressive. Some of them have direct contracts negotiated with hospitals and doctors. But each of them is a Christian organization. They love the Lord, and they are really great. I get to work with all of them every day, and they're just really good organizations.
What's really great to know that there is not only a third-party group that gives this endorsement thing that you were talking about, but the Alliance itself is that kind of a weeding out process for those bad actors in this business. And it only stands to reason that human nature being what it is, that's going to happen from time to time. So that's great. The Alliance of Healthcare Sharing Ministries, Executive Director Katie Talento is my guest today. I'll be back with Katie talking about something really important, and that would be the whole role of public trust. Do we still have that today in our whole healthcare industry? Do we have that with our leaders in general? We're going to talk about that in a moment when we return. This is Afternoons with Mike.
Join host Mike Gilland for The Shepherd at Work every Saturday morning at 10:05 a.m. You will be introduced to a marketplace leader that will help you learn to walk out your faith wherever you live and work. The Shepherd at Work is sponsored by the Central Florida Christian Chamber, building kingdom, business, and community throughout our area. That's The Shepherd at Work, this Saturday morning at 10:05 a.m.
Katie Talento is my guest, Executive Director of the Alliance of Healthcare Sharing Ministries. I mentioned in the first segment that she has some White House experience. I know that you were appointed. And tell us about that. Who appointed you? What your role was at the White House?
Yeah, so I had worked in the United States Senate for on and off for 15 years for a bunch of different senators. And I was in the Senate. I kind of was always trying to get out because I never really respected government very much. So I was always in and out. But right before the 2016 election, I was in and I was working for a senator from North Carolina. And a friend of mine became the policy director for the Trump campaign. And when I saw him a few months after that, he was like, you know, haggard. He had sleep deprived. He was chain smoking. He had lost weight. It was terrible. I said, oh my goodness, do you need some help? My gosh, I mean, I can help you. My goodness. And so that was the beginning. So I started helping on the Trump campaign, went to the convention to work on the platform committee of the convention, and then into eventually into Trump Tower during the last few months, and the transition team from there in November and December, and then into the White House. So really it's the, as you get to know the campaign people and they start to develop the appointed leaders in the White House, those people are the ones that would appoint me and, mm-hmm. and did. It was fun.
And you served there right in the White House. I think that is so incredible. Yeah. And a lot of people would wonder what it was like. And I would love to know what your thoughts are about the way things are shaping up in this race right now. It's looking like a rematch of 2020.
Yeah, it sure is. Although I hope the result is different. But yeah, I mean, working in the White House is, it's for a policy staffer, you know, I'm kind of a policy wonk and had always done health policy. It's working in the White House is like playing in the Super Bowl. So it's just the absolute dream job. Every day I sort of want to put forks in my eyes. And I also can't believe they let me in the complex every day. You know, it's both great. highs and lows. So it's really, really hard and it's almost impossible. The portfolio of issues is far too huge for any normal person to handle. And so you can never do all the work you have to do. So there's a little stress and anxiety about that. And then on the other hand, you get to do the most amazing things and work with the smartest and the smartest people and get to meet amazing people and obviously interact with the president and all the fun things, riding on Air Force One and meeting, you know, famous people and seeing amazing things. So it's really fun. But obviously, I was there to change the world, right? And so the policies we were able to enact, including price transparency, but also, I would say I also worked the social issues. So I was in charge of the pro-life agenda. And so doing all the pro-life policy measures that President Trump enacted was really exciting. Helping save the Little Sisters of the Poor from the Obama administration's persecution under the ACA, just religious liberty and, you know, standing for that is so important. It was one of the first things we did, enacting Mexico City policy, which protected taxpayers from having to fund abortions overseas. So all of those things were super fun. And I mean, it was great. It's the sort of thing that my husband thought of it as a military deployment, you know, like, you do it for a little while, you can't do it forever. And it's not sustainable for family life, but I'm grateful for the few years that I was there.
Now, the pressure that people like you, that you went through that, and you think about the presidents in the past, we've seen kind of side-by-side comparisons, A-B comparisons of what they looked like when they went in, what they look like when they came out. It has exactly. A tendency to weigh down deeply on one's physical body, doesn't it?
Oh, it absolutely does. I don't know anybody whose body did not fall apart. I mean, mine certainly did. I had all kinds of, you know, crazy pains and, you know, you go in with a healthy body and you get out. I mean, actually, you don't even go in healthy because you'd been on a campaign and then transition team. And so, you know, the meltdown had started, but it was rough. It was really rough. And it's hard on the family for sure and kids. And, you know, you can kind of offset it by, I got to take my kids to the White House movie theater and the Trump family was right in front of us. And, you know, so that's always fun. You can go to fun 4th of July parties on the White House lawn, but I don't think that those few events really make up for all the days and nights of mom not being there. So it's not sustainable for the long term, but it's a wonderful, wonderful experience.
Well, all of that obviously changed in 2020. And now here we are almost 4 years later. 4 years since the election cycle, for sure, and things are not going so great in America. Although, if you only took the State of the Union address and you weighed everything out according to what we heard the other night, things have never, ever been rosier and better in America. And I don't think most Americans believe what they heard. I really think that there was a credibility gap that is alive and well. And one of the things I know that you are addressing right now is the reality that our American public does not trust what's going on right now. Would you agree?
Oh, 100%. I mean, I honestly think that that's actually a feature, not a bug, of the COVID pandemic, is that it sort of woke everybody up to the lies and the sort of incompetence of government, which is very healthy. Wake up. So I think, you know, if you trust your government, like, you have a problem. That's not the system our founding fathers imagined. And so I think it's good and healthy the lack of trust, and it really places the responsibility for our own health and our own family's well-being squarely where it belongs, which is with you and your family.
Well, there is a lot there that we all have to jump in and do. And again, going back to that whole concept of low-hanging fruit, Katie, what do you think Americans can do right now in this environment of not trusting our government, not trusting our healthcare leaders, not trusting, let's say, those organizations like the World Health Organization, WHO? Because we all saw that a lot was happening, even on those people that came on our TVs every night during the pandemic, the Faucis, et cetera. What is going to be the low-hanging fruit that we can look at and say, okay, we got to get this right first? What would that be?
Yeah, I mean, I think in your own family, taking a hard look at our own food supply and how we eat in our families, because big food and big ag are not looking out for you. And if you don't look out for you, the FDA and the USDA are not going to protect you. And we've seen, you know, a dramatic increase in chronic illness among our children. You know, autism went from 1 in 1,000 children, you know, just a few years ago, and now it's 1 in 34.
Wow.
So it's even higher among boys. It's like 1 in 20. So, you know, nobody is talking about this and what could possibly be causing it. And we don't know what's causing it. I'm not suggesting that it's food or whatever. I'm just saying that chronic illness is rampant. You know, more than half of American children have one chronic disease already. So this is totally unprecedented. You know, a generation ago, and certainly our parents' generation, like, fat and sick kids were not a thing. You know, it was, I remember when I was growing up in the 80s, there were no peanut allergies. That wasn't a thing. So something dramatic has changed, dramatic. And there are only a few possible candidates for that change that have happened all over the country. It's not like it's localized in this area or that area. So it can't be some local environmental exposure or something, right? It has to be something we're all doing. So what are we all doing? Well, we're all eating processed food. We're all, you know, drinking water from taps. We're all, you know, drinking sodas all the time. And there are a number of other candidates. There are some other exposures that, you know, we all are getting more and more screen time and electromagnetic radiation and cell towers. There's all kinds of candidates for what might be causing these problems. But the first thing I would do in a family is start to really take a look at our food. And if you don't know where your food comes from, if you don't know your local farmers, if you don't go to your farmer's market, if your great grandmother wouldn't recognize that food as food fit for humans, then don't feed it to your family, especially your children.
You know, that's something that we all can do a better job in. I think Americans have just gotten a bit lazy. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, it's been by design. I mean, we're a little bit victims of these same types of swampian corporate interests that we were talking about in healthcare. When it comes to food and environment and cell phones and, you know, TV, like, there are money-making interests that are behind that want us fat and sick and, you know, sitting around watching advertising. So I think it takes real effort to combat that today. Real effort. You almost have to be like a crazy countercultural person. But you know, that's what Christ calls us to anyway. We're countercultural in a lot of ways, maybe not enough, but we should be. And we know, you know, we as Christians know that more than anybody. And so, you know, sort of applying that same approach to the way we live in terms of our wellness and our health and our families that we apply in terms of our morality and, you know, our religious beliefs and exercise, you know, that's not something new for Christians. And we need to adopt that in those practices, just like we do in our faith practices.
You know, just like you mentioned with food for our physical bodies, you also mentioned screen time. And that's something that we've talked about often on my program about the role that kids have in watching their tablets or their cell phones. Almost every kid has maybe one or both of those things, and the amount of hours that they are involved with that device, it's unknown what kind of impact that's making on their mental behavior, their brain activity even. It's all up in the air as to what kind of impact that's going to have long term.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, I often sort of commiserate with my friends that we are the first parents, you know, we're the first generation of parents in the digital age and sort of the post-Christian age too. And the combination of those two things, how we protect our children, you know, I'm addicted to my phone too. So it's really hard for me to, you know, be a good example to my children and now my grandchildren. And I remember, you know, we tried not to buy our kids phones until the very last possible minute when there was absolutely no way. And our kids thought that we were the craziest, meanest people ever and that they were so left out. And, you know, it's really, really hard for parents. And there's no manual for how to navigate this in the digital age, how to protect your children, you know. And so I don't know what the right answer is, but I know it's not the status quo and it's not the prevailing culture all around us.
Oh, boy, that is some really great advice right there, that we've just got to get a hold of this. And the picture that we often see at a restaurant is a family all sitting around a table and every one of them with their heads down looking at their phones. That is something that people can change and should change. And I agree with you that if you haven't yet given your child a phone, don't put it off as long as you can, because again, we just have no idea how those things are reshaping the brain waves and all the neurons and the way they fire in our brain. It's all being changed by what we do and the environment that we're in. So Katie, give us again, if you will, the website for how people can find out more about the Alliance for Healthcare Sharing Ministries.
Yes, you can reach us at ahcsm.org. We're also on Facebook at Alliance-HCSM and Twitter at Alliance-HCSM.
It's been great to talk with you today. Katie Tolento, the Executive Director of the Alliance, thank you for being with me once again.
It's my delight, Mike. Thank you so much.
All right, and we'll see you guys next time right here on Afternoons with Mike.